Forte.
Oh yeah, I got Junior Gautier, the Dig Black. They're like the height of the ankle boot. They're like high tops. They look, sorry, make a left. They look like a black wedge
ish
shell toe.
Because he's original. I love his shoes. And that's really what he's made for. And he doesn't really stop at a limit. He just keeps on going and like doesn't mind that someone may scorn at his shoes and say, who would ever have thought of that? But he's very original and he just like knows what he's doing. And so, about young designers being inspired, there's good brands like Michael Kors and Calvin Klein who make regular day shoes and clothes, but once in a while they make fancy poofy dresses. But Valentino and Chanel, since Chanel is also my favorite brand, probably aren't going to... Valentino and Chanel probably are going to be the ones who really inspire other designers. Because Valentino, there was one of my favorite pieces, a pink dress with a sort of pink circular shawl around it. Most people wouldn't have thought of that, and most people would never have thought of that, actually. But because of Valentino, he thought of it, and that's probably going to inspire lots of designers. And, like, there's Chanel, and the little black dress. That's definitely going to evolve because in a few years, maybe there'll be the little black shorts or the little black shirt or the little black shoes. And, like, as Karl Lagerfeld has been adding his own kind of twist to Chanel. There's the regular tweed jacket and tweed skirt, and then there's a big clunky belt and lots of clunky jewelry that's gonna like inspire others to make also very interesting clothes. And so definitely I like Christiane Louboutin because like the red soles are original. The flats are original, the little handbags are original, the clutches, I mean. And, like, definitely I find that shoes are the most important accessory, well, other than jewelry. But, like, in jewelry, it really matters where you are. Because, like, if you're in the country, you're probably not going to wear your best diamonds and your fancy Valentino dress. You'll probably wear, like, as fashion is going Bohemians, most brands, like your Ralph Lauren polo pants, polo shirt, and maybe your just like plain gold necklace instead of the very best diamonds. But lots of things are evolving. Like I've talked to many jewelers from Van Cleef & Arpels, Tiffany's, and they're all saying, Cartier, they're all saying that white gold is the new thing. That like it's just changing and it's never gonna be the same. But still, we'll always look up to Chanel, Pucci, Gucci, all those brands. And those will inspire us, but we'll also make new things. And it doesn't like Alexander McQueen. Some people think he's weird. Some people thought that he didn't really have a sense of style. But he's one of my favorite designers, and he's probably definitely going to inspire some people, some young designers. I've talked to some young designers, and they're saying that, like, Alexander McQueen definitely, and some other brands, because they're also original, and they're not, like, afraid to take a risk. Like, that's how Marc Jacobs became one of the top he used to work for Yves Saint Laurent, and then he made a huge mistake. Yves Saint Laurent fired him, but everyone loved that mistake he made on the dress. I'm not saying to make a, you have to make a mistake to become a top of the top, but like you could get friendly with some of their top designers, and or you could work for one of them, and you can just like learn. Fashion can show your identity. Like, if you're showing what you like, if you're showing what you dislike, you're showing the kind of the just like what you're against. You can all wear it, and you can show it by just wearing it. Like, you can wear all black if you dislike every other color, and when people see you in the street, they may think, well, either you're goth, you're emo, or you just don't really like other colors. Or if you're all flowery, like springtime, people know you're into spring.
On top of the jacket? What?
Also,
a mannequin with a towel on its head? Holy shit!
Comes between you and me, nothing.
This is cool. That's
good.
That's great.
Yeah, I like that. That's a good twist on it with the high cut.
Everything is scary on a skateboard. Not having a care in the world, that's the easy part. I'm gonna quit. I'm going home.
Despite the unpredictable career and style of Alexander McQueen, his suicide this winter came as a complete shock. Adored by magazine editors, buyers, celebrities, and the fashion press, he appeared to be at the height of his career. He was hailed as a genius of clothing design for his impeccable tailoring and construction skills, but it was his extraordinary runway shows and public persona that helped him to transcend the elite fashion circles of London and Paris, making him a celebrity. Unlike most of the fashion world's famous designers, he was unafraid to embrace the gritty underside of urban life, taking inspiration from the detritus of a young, careless life. London nightclubs, horror films, street style. He built his reputation on realizing clothing that embodied the sparkling ideals of nature and beauty, as well as costumes for the darkest scenes to emerge from a depressed imagination. He was capable of showing complete honesty in his work. The clothes he produced were remarkable, but his runway presentations were spectacular. What many of his peers view as a parade of glamorous photo opportunities, exercises in displaying the latest collection for buyers and press, McQueen used the opportunity to produce extravagant circuses, ranging from the operatic to the grotesque. Disregarding the fashion world's habitual attempts to pander to ideals of glamour, sex appeal, and youth, McQueen's shows made the old standards seem outdated, even irrelevant. He staged productions that exhibited terrifying futuristic technology, nightmarish scenes from horror films, and haunting scenes of destruction and trauma. But even at the height of his theatricality, his shows never compromised his talent in clothing design or hid his romantic disposition. At his best, they were unfailingly exquisite declarations of love and despair, and occasionally even an immature sense of humor and delight. His last complete runway show, Plato's Atlantis, features models resembling reptilian sea creatures from the future. With sculpted hair and graphic, computer-manipulated serpentine prints, models were transformed into graceful snake-like creatures, gliding over a pristine white runway like pale, glittering monsters. Enormous remote-controlled cameras followed their every move, eventually moving their gaze over the audience, the images projected onto the clinical white walls resembling security camera footage. The glamorous heroines of a post-apocalyptic sci-fi horror movie, McQueen proposed a glimpse of futuristic glamour and femininity. For spring-summer 1999, McQueen had model Shalom Harlow standing on a rotating platform, while her pristine white dress is spray-painted by two robotic paint machines. The spray paint machines were on loan from Fiat, the Italian car manufacturers. Her despair at having her perfect white dress soiled, followed by her resign from trying to escape the paint guns, was McQueen's vision of a future where humans fear, but ultimately surrender to technological rule. McQueen's dark tastes were perfectly suited to live in horror films. For spring-summer 2004, he replaced a runway presentation with a stage reenactment of the 1969 film They Shoot Horses, Don't They? A dark film depicting elegant, dazzling dancers testing their psychological and physical limits in a depression-style dance endurance contest. Outfitting professional dancers in the season's collection, the audience watched an abbreviated reenactment of the film instead of a traditional runway show. 1 year later, McQueen's spring-summer 2005 runway show was directly inspired by the film Picnic at Hanging Rock. The story is about a group of friends who go to a picnic where all but one of them mysteriously disappear. McQueen's collection is modeled after the girls' classic prep school wardrobes, which come to contrast the characters' hysterical demeanors. Soon, most of them mysteriously disappear, leaving the rest of the characters to contemplate murder, the ominous natural world, and criminal tension, while the characters maintain their beautiful feminine appearances. For spring-summer 2008, McQueen once again turned to dark fiction as inspiration, this time looking to Alfred Hitchcock's 1963 classic, The Birds. Showing perfectly tailored period pieces while evoking a dark, menacing mood was a recipe for his uncompromising artistic design while attaining broad commercial success. Many of his most memorable shows were his darkest, his most violent, displaying horror and psychological drama. His 1996 collection, entitled Highland Rape, was a reference to the Scottish genocide that claimed a number of McQueen's ancestors. Dressing models as rape victims, complete with bloody wounds and torn clothing, was a controversial highlight early in his career. In 2001, the spring-summer show commenced with delaying the show by an hour, while the audience uncomfortably avoided its own reflection in a huge mirrored cube in the center of the stage. He seemed to relish making his guests feeling slightly uncomfortable and self-conscious. The show concluded with the walls of the box falling down, revealing a nude obese woman breathing through a tube. She released black moths into the air. For fall-winter 2006, the designer replaced models with a giant hologram of model Kate Moss, wearing one of the designer's dresses for the season. While the rest of the show continued, the image remained as a beautiful ghost. One of his last shows, fall-winter 2009, featured many of his most well-received designs, darkly reinterpreted for pessimistic times. The show took place at the height of the global recession, and the centerpiece of the stage featured an enormous pile of stage props from a number of McQueen's previous shows, all painted black, resembling the world's chicest landfill. That McQueen revised some of his best designs was nothing new for him. Many of his collections featured the best of the previous collections, revised and reinterpreted to suit his mercurial moods. This is not to say he was entirely tortured. At least publicly, his sense of humor was apparent in many of his projects. He chalked "I'm a cunt" into a suit made for the Prince of Wales. One season, he took a final bow at his runway show wearing a bunny costume. As adored as he was, it was apparent that he remained restless, unsatisfied. We must assume that such elaborate productions come at the high cost of emotional and creative exhaustion. He gave it everything he had.
You like?
I'm going with it.
Yeah.
I'm going with it.
Okay.
I'm going with it.
Okay, yeah.
Definitely.
Okay.
I'm going
with that too.
because of the way you walk you with this dress.
Okay, I'm testing the volume.
All right.
And let's see how it works with vehicles.
Okay, coming up on park. Let's see, busy streets.
Okay, we're going.
Oh. Hi. Walking up park on the way to the... where are we going? Cooper Hewitt? No, not Cooper
Hewitt.
Yeah.
For the Rodarte show.
Can't wait to see it.
Very excited.
Yes.
One of the few designers in New York that we both agree on.
Well, I mean, I don't know. I don't think you liked their show. This new collection so much, right? You didn't really like the white collection.
I thought it was a little heavy, and it seemed a little forced with so many layers. Because normally I think of their collections as very light and more for spring, so maybe they were going out of their way to do something for winter.
I mean, I think it felt light, though, you know, because, just everything being white, you know, and then they had a lot of sort of chiffon and lacy type looks that I actually thought felt kind of year-round in a way. I mean, I just like that it's sort of, you know, it's always identifiably Rodarte. You know, you can tell they have a real identity.
That's true.
They inspired a lot of people and still do, and you still kind of know what is their collection. So, for that reason, I liked it. You know.
I liked that that their influences are becoming more noticeable in New York. Because I feel like in the beginning they were doing their own thing. It wasn't really part of what anybody else was doing.
I almost liked what they did, though, from the beginning. I thought it was always interesting and sort of detail-obsessed and crafty and, you know, involved.
Right, but don't you think it was so uniquely theirs? And, like...
Yeah, I mean, they definitely have their unique... and it definitely really developed, I think, the further they went. But it still had, you know, it had sort of some principles of other designers, you know, even like, say, like Len Van and said sort of relaxed, sort of elegant, you know, washed raw edges, you know, craft. It sort of had certain elements of that, you know. So, but definitely a unique point of view.
I guess what I was thinking is in the beginning they used to just do a few small pieces, and it wasn't really a collection, and it was more like made to order and just showing their craft.
Yeah.
And now that they're thinking bigger in terms of a full collection, you're finally seeing something that's wearable and part of somebody's wardrobe, you know?
Right.
Like more cohesive.
Right. Well, yes, Mobama wore a dress of theirs.
Yes.
Maybe you might not know that that is necessarily theirs, you know? But maybe it was Target collection. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, I'm right.
Just kidding. No. But
do you think Michelle Obama is a muse of theirs, or is it just accidental that she wore their?
I don't know. I don't know if it's arranged. You never know with these things. Is it arranged? Was it bought? You know. I mean, I know that she sort of relied on Ikram a lot from Chicago.
Right.
For advice, but I don't know if it like ended up in Ikram's store and then she's like, oh, you gotta get this dress. I don't know. But I don't know.
I like to think that there's not a huge team of people throwing things at her and that she has a hand at picking what she's gonna wear.
I'm sure in the end she really does choose.
It seems personal. It seems more suited to her.
I mean, I think she came up with, I think her look is her look, you know? Sort of not, doesn't look like a stylist put her together, right?
I also like that she doesn't look like a first lady. She just looks like a
no,
woman
she looks
going
like a first
to
lady.
What do you think?
Yeah. She looks like a little like Jackie. Oh, I mean, you know, she has that kind of, very, I'm not going to say proper, but a modern type of proper, you know.
So you think she's aware of her role and her dress reflects her role?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Definitely. You know, but maybe this is exactly how she likes to dress anyway. You know what I mean?
Right.
So.
That's kind of what I think. It's because.
Yeah, it's definitely personal.
It's so accessible.
Yeah.
A style. It's not
like
a stiff Laura Bush, Oscar de la Renta gown, which doesn't even reflect her own style. It's just glued onto her.
I mean, it does have that like early 60s, though, proportion. In a, you know, in that modern way, though, but everything, you know, down to the cardigan, you know, it does have that look.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the shit's great. I don't know, that's where Lisa's kids go to school.
Oh, cool.
Is this, are we on 92nd?
This is 92nd, yeah. I think it's nice that a first lady can be a muse, because for so long, you don't really, I mean, I guess since Jackie, you don't associate a first lady with style, or...
No, not really, but you know, I mean, Nancy Reagan did, you know, she did have her, hers was Adolfo. She was very St. John Adolfo, Oscar de la Renta even. She was very that. So, yeah, she would argue with you that she also was the first lady of fashion influence.
Mm-hmm.
But it's been a long time, for sure. This doesn't seem right, does it? Maybe it's...
Yeah, it does.
It does?
Well, I mean, I think we're fine. It's like...
Well, I mean, I know it's up here, but I think maybe we overshot it. It doesn't look like it's down yet. What else are we doing today?
Let's check out the Tino Segal show at the Guggenheim.
Okay.
If you have time.
I'm gonna make some time because I want to see it. Even though I have to work. Today!
What are you working on?
Today? I have to... work on Scissor Sisters for the tour.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to work on designs for Lisa for the Met Ball.
Mm-hmm.
Those are like the main ones. These are the two major things I have to come into. And get the shoes, right? Design shoes.
Does it all overlap for you, or do you need to compartmentalize different projects?
I mean, they're all compartmentalized, you know, in a way, because, you know, it's like, as you see in my studio, in my office, it's like, you know, on my big 8-foot boards, it's like everyone has boards up all around the room.
Uh-huh.
So in a way, I sort of divide it all up together, but, you know, I can't stop thinking of one over the other, necessarily, you know. It's like they're always there. Sort of continually thinking about them whenever I sort of get an idea about one or the other. You know, it's funny, Shelby was, she brought that up the other day. She's like, how do you do it? It's like, how do you do it? How do you keep it all in your head at the same time? She's like, I'm like, it's because you just never stop thinking about them, you know? That's all. What do you think, up or down?
Down. Well, also
down.
This brings to mind, a recent criticism of the fashion business is that it forces designers to do too many collections in one year.
Right.
It puts too much pressure on designers and also thins out the product.
Yes, Donna Karan being a leader of this view.
Yes.
And, ooh, look at the sign.
You know, I even heard people blaming, or not blaming, but discussing McQueen's death in terms of, oh, was there too much pressure on him?
Oh, and Stefan Altanshi.
Yeah.
Yes. I mean, clearly, I mean, something has to change about fashion. I mean, it doesn't... Something has to change. It's not working, you know. They just... How to change it and what to... I'm going to take a picture of...
We were talking about pressure on designers to sort of grow their business,
right,
and show more collections. And
right. I know. I mean, it is a lot when you're at that level. There is, like, I don't even know, 12 more collections that you do a year. I mean, that's a lot. I don't know how people do it.
Do you think it's because...
I mean, with, I know with more people, obviously, bigger staff.
Do you think it's indicative of, like, the Gucci group and the LVMH group and those sort of big business families that force designers to do that, or...
Well, I mean, I think it's also, you know, it's all, like, it's retailers, you know, wanting, you know, fresh product in the stores, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You know, because, you know, it's like fashion...
I once asked Cindy Sherman for a job. She said... You gave me the job, and now I'm doing the job, and now you want me to give you a job? How does that work? I needed help bad.
I'm not a big fan of Sex and the City, but there's one episode in particular which probably deserves a closer look. It's an episode from the sixth and last season of this... wannabe mix of romantic and dramatic and comedy series. It was on TV for quite a long time and is always on reruns as well. The episode, titled One, starts off with a trip to the Sean Kelly Gallery for the characters Carrie Bradshaw and Charlotte York. Carrie is the main protagonist of the show, and she's portrayed by Sarah Jessica Parker. Carrie is accompanying her friend Charlotte for a gallery visit. In earlier seasons of the show, it's been established that Charlotte works at a gallery. She graduated from Smith College with a major in art history and a minor in finance. At Sean Kelly in Chelsea, the two are looking at a piece from a show by Marina Abramovich called House with an Ocean View. The artist lived in three rooms that were elevated in the gallery space, and she lived in the gallery space for 12 days. Performing everyday tasks. The three rooms were all missing one wall, so that was the fourth wall facing the visitors. So each task and each movement was made visible to the audience. Carrie, who's not accustomed to being in the galleries or having any part of the gallery world, is impatient, and she makes a few jokes about the artwork and laughs out loud in the gallery space. Her laughter is met with contempt for the more experienced gallery visitors. Looking around the space, kind of embarrassed, Carrie spots an intriguing man, who later disappears in the crowd. As the two women are about to leave the gallery, the mysterious man reappears, and Charlotte reveals that he is the famous Russian artist Alexander Petrovsky. Charlotte approaches the artist and gushing over him, and she tells him that he was the first important sale she had in the art world. This gushing establishes her on the wrong side of the tracks, as a dealer or someone who's in the art world just for the money. The artist, portrayed by Mikhail Beroshnikov, asks Carrie what she thinks of the Marina Abramovich piece. Carrie lies, says it's good, but then she blurts out her excuse, "I'm not very arty." This establishes her as more of a novice in the art world, and she continues to draw comedic analogies to ordinary women living in New York, locked up in their buildings, waiting for the phone to ring, so they can't leave their apartment. Carrie expresses distrust in the artist's statement that she's staying in the gallery for 24 hours a day, and says that anyone comes back to the gallery at night to see the performance, the artist would be out having a cheeseburger. After a midnight date later on in the episode, Carrie and Alexander go back to the gallery space. The artist is still there, perhaps waiting for the non-existing phone to ring or a cheeseburger to appear. Alexander makes a joke, and then Carrie shushes him, and she reproduces the same behavior and reaction she received at her initial visit to the gallery space. The artist lifts her eyebrows and smirks at Carrie like they share a secret, or that Carrie got the better idea by being on a date and not being stuck in the gallery like she is. This particular episode was written after some of the writers of Sex and the City visited the actual exhibition by Marina Abramovich at the Sean Kelly Gallery during the winter of 2002. One was shot over the course of 2 weeks at a later date, long after the exhibition closed, meaning that the whole installation had to be reinstalled, copyright issues had to be worked out, and the gallery's schedule and opening hours were compromised in one way or another. The usual backdrops of the show, which is usually luxury goods outlets, the girls are seen all over New York City at different stores, different functions, different parties. They're at the Prada store, they're probably at a lot of other luxury stores as well. And they also visit each other in fabulous apartments and townhouses and so on. So, of course, it's a lifestyle of the rich and famous, and a lot of the sort of backdrops for the different episodes are, in fact, the stores, the retail stores. The businesses that are featured have an interest in being featured on such a successful show like Sex and the City. It achieves wide exposure that it no doubt would lead to financial gain. It also leads to expanded interest in the brand recognition, and also it makes the luxury art goods market available and desirable to other segments, not just in New York City or the US, but all over the world. And hopefully they will also want to take part in the world that is portrayed in Sex and the City. The episode marked the first time a gallery was featured to such an extent on a television show, at least to my knowledge. There are of course plenty of memorable and maybe not so memorable portrayals of artists and the art world in mass media, but in my mind this appearance equates the gallery with all the other businesses and brands featured in the series, and makes the gallery world and the art world seem like another luxury good and the same type of function as the luxury goods market. I mean, the Sean Kelly logo is visible on the door to the gallery, and you can also hear the receptionist of the gallery speak the name of the gallery when she answers the phone. The appearance of the gallery will also lead to the same benefits described for other businesses. There's also the work of an artist featured in the show, and this work by Marina Abramovich is not a pastiche or a direct appropriation of an artist's work. This is the actual piece by this very prominent contemporary artist who also has a show up at MoMA at the moment as well. It's reconstructed and reperformed. The artist herself was not performing in the episode, but an actress was hired to play the part and made to look like Abramovich using hair and makeup. The gallery and the artist had script approval, and Abramovich was later asked by the New York Times about her involvement in the show and said, "It's fantastic. Popular culture absorbing me." There are plenty of other crossovers as well between the art world, mass media, and also equating the art world with fashion as well. Another example, which is also quite recent from 2005, is Vanessa Beecroft's piece for L'Espace Louis Vuitton in Paris. It's an exhibition venue which is tucked into the same building as Louis Vuitton's flagship store in Paris. Beecroft herself is no stranger to using fashion or the luxury goods market, having her work appear as fashion editorials in magazines such as Self Service, and using designer bags, shoes, and clothes in her performances. for the exhibition at the Louis Vuitton Espace, she put her trademark nude models on shelves alongside Louis Vuitton bags. In addition, she reproduced the Louis Vuitton monogram, the L and the V, spelling out the two letters with the naked models' bodies. And in an interview, Beecroft said, "I absolutely never had the feeling of compromising myself while I made this alphabet for Louis Vuitton. I was more worried about the idea of creating a performance for a store and not for a museum. But as I have said, I was very satisfied with the result." End quote. So that's just two examples of many between the crossover between art and the luxury goods market, reaching beyond the gallery space and retail stores into mass media and people's homes. To many people, the most important examples would probably be Cindy Sherman's work, the Comme des Garçons, the fashion spreads, or Takahashi Murakami's long-standing involvement also with Louis Vuitton, designing bags and textiles used for the company. There's also Tracy Emin's luggage design for Longchamp, and even just the sort of day-to-day basis, not just talking products, but that the connection between the art world and the fashion world is there, like Tom Ford interviewing artist Jeff Koons for the Sundance Channel's Iconoclast series. So, just a few examples of these kinds of crossovers. There are numerous of them, and it's sort of just an indication of the flirtation between art and fashion. There's also the reciprocity as well. It's not just the fashion flirting with the art. There's also art flirting with fashion and so on. And also to the level of just the ads that are appearing in Art Firm almost every month. The sort of six-page Yves Saint Laurent ads in Art Forum, for example, appearing alongside ads for galleries and education and so on. So the real stake high-end fashion has in being seen and worn in the art world as well. You're supposed to look your best. Curators are dressing in black, but not just any black. It's labeled as well. You know, the art world and the fashion world serving the same or similar segments of the public, namely the luxury goods market, making this cross-pollination of art and fashion financially interesting under the guise of art projects or patronage from the arts. But there are, of course, the differences between the art world and the fashion world. If we come to the conclusion that art is part of the same luxury goods market as fashion is, you could say that art also occupies a privileged spot, a very specific segment of the luxury goods market, separating art namely from other luxury goods such as designer clothes, handbags, cars, potentially making art the ultimate luxury good. This appointed spot of privilege has been anointed over the years by infusing art with qualities that luxury goods do not have. And there are several theoretical frameworks available to explain how art attained this heightened status. Art has historically been linked with the elite, with money and so on, just like fashion has. But certain shifts in the market economy and the trajectory of art drastically changed how art was sold and offered. With the apparent decline of the two main segments responsible for consuming, purveying, and displaying of art, namely aristocracy and the church, and with the advent of modernism, art departed from a skill and craft-based system into a system of ideas and avant-garde, and also into non-object-based art as well. So how do you sell an idea, and how do you give economical value to something that might appear to be, for example, an unfinished painting? Well, you dress it up in discourse. You have many examples of this kind of discourse. For example, the culture industry by Adorno and Horkheimer is one good point of departure, which most people are familiar with within the art world. That's one way of dressing up art and making sure that it has a unique position, a contrast to the position of, for example, fashion. So, that's back again to the episode one of Sex in the City, because it marks a significant shift, sort of undresses the art world again and puts it on the same playing field as other luxury goods. So the question is this transparency or undressing of high art, the art world, significant, or is it just a fluke? Is it a gallery wanting to gain publicity, brand recognition, and so on? Is it just an isolated incident, or is there something else there as well? Is it okay for a gallery to be in Sex and the City? Is it going to lose money for being on the show? Well, I don't think so.
Beauty must be as isolating as genius. When people look at you, they're so dazzled, you must never know if they actually see you, the deep and complicated person you really are.
I think it's possible to assume, without involving oneself into bigger problems, that we are usually accustomed to distinguish between art and fashion. While art, on the one hand, seems to stimulate us to be reflective, analytical and critical, not only towards the artworks, but also towards the political, economic and social conditions of our times. Fashion, on the other hand, does not really do this. Fashion does not really stimulate us to be reflective or critical. Fashion rather seems to be immediately embedded in the everyday culture of our lives. And as such, fashion seems only to address our lower desires and drives, and it appears, therefore, as a superficial attraction and seduction. And even if it's, of course, also possible to see that the contemporary art world is more and more determined by certain kinds of fashions, I think it's necessary still to recognize the reason why we still use to make such distinctions between art and fashion in the first place.
Shut down. Shit down. Am I a feminist?
The reason why we do that is the museum and the gallery. Because it is a museum and the gallery which allows us in the first place not only to take a certain distance to an artwork, to take some time to reflect and be critical about an artwork. The museum also allows us to revisit an artwork over and over again. It is, for example, possible to go to a museum, see a Greek statue, and come back again, see it again, watch it again, think about it again. The same thing we can do, of course, with an avant-gardistic painting or even a postmodern video installation. Fashion, on the other hand, seems to appear only on the streets. It appears on the streets and disappears on the streets from one moment to another. It follows a certain rhythm of appearance and disappearance. At a certain moment, for example, we like certain kind of styles, certain colors, certain kind of jackets. And at the other moment, we don't like that at all anymore. We just don't want to see it. We don't want to wear it. And even worse, we feel embarrassed about it. Like, we don't want to appear outdated and outmoded. We don't want to appear like as if we would not belong to this time anymore.
Sad.
So, even if all this is true, I think what is often overseen is that fashion does not really appear immediately on the streets.
I really love the gloves, by the way.
I think it's possible to assume that fashion has a medium, which is advertisement. And it is an advertisement, i.e. in TV commercials, in magazines, in billboards, that fashion appears for the first time for us.
But I don't know what else it could do with the hair.
So, and it's of course possible to revisit fashion and its medium and its advertisements over and over again, in the same way as we revisit artworks. And if we do so, then fashion suddenly starts to appear as an artifact. Somehow, as soon as the immediate relations and functions of fashion in a certain word at a certain time disappear, fashion does not only seem old and outdated, it somehow becomes interesting. It is simply not seductive anymore. Like, we don't feel anymore certain necessity to go outside and to buy this product we see, because this product most of the time does not really exist any longer.
Like, look at this.
So, but we also don't feel really embarrassed about it. Something else happens. We somehow think what we see there is somehow interesting. So we become like reflective, analytical, and critical about it. At least we have the possibility to do that. And it is in this way that I recently watched a series of Calvin Klein commercials from the 80s starring Brooke Shields in it. A friend was sending to me. And in one of these clips, Brooke Shields is laying on the ground, facing in the camera, and addressing her viewers with this very interesting sentence, which reads, "There are two kinds of people who wear Calvins, those who want to remember and those who want to forget."
What?
What struck me here is not only the seductive nuance that emphasizes the last part of the sentence. As if there would be, on the one hand, a promise to forget. Something like a silent understanding of what it means to be able to forget. Which is, of course, the possibility to let one's desires and drives go. To experience some kind of unlimited joy or something. But more important for me was the understanding of the all-inclusiveness the sentence expresses.
Everybody's wearing this red shoes.
For it's not only the people who are able to enjoy mass culture, right? Who be able to not remember, who are able, and not only be able, but who even want to forget, who even want to not be critical, who even want to just follow their desires, right, and have an easy life. It's not only those people who wear Calvins, it is also those people who want to remember, those people who want to be critical. So fashion somehow appears as this exceeding medium which includes all kinds of people. In a way, we could say it includes art people and non-art people, right? It includes these people who always want to be reflective, critical, and includes these people who just don't care about it, who are not interested in it, who are just interested in their own fun and their own enjoyment. So what we find here is, of course, like a very interesting political dimension. And if we start to think about that, it appears that this political dimension is not accidental. In a way, this political dimension is essential for the logic of fashion as such. If we, for example, look at the etymology of fashion, we see that it derives over the French façon back and leads us back to the Latin factionem, which means a group of people acting together. Similarly, the German translation of fashion is mode, which also arrives from mode and leads us back to the Latin modus, which means rule, measure, or method to do something.
Yes.
In both cases, it seems that fashion implies here the possibility of a community. Fashion implies the possibility to be with. And I think one could argue that containing this political logic it is also the reason for the political critique on fashion. For even if fashion contains really such an essential political logic, it is still seen as outworded, as superficial, and provokes in this way a constant suspicion. So there is this irreducible suspicion against fashion, that it's only spectacle, that it's only fake, that it's only simulacrum. And fashion in this way, it's a paradox, right? It's not only the condition to be with, right? It's not only the possibility for a community, but it also destabilizes the possibility of a community. And it is therefore that we, at least since Nietzsche, hear this repetitive call for authenticity, for an actual individual decision. For the possibility to be or to not be within a community should not be found on the outside. The decision to be with or not with other people, to be in a community, to be with someone else, should be made on the inside and only on the inside. The problem is, of course, that already the constitution of the individual already depends on fashion. In another clip of this Calvin Klein series, we see or we hear Brooke Shards whistling like a certain melody. I don't know actually what it is. But then we also see a tracking shot starting at her brown leather boots. The camera moves up, shows us her spread legs embedded in his very tight Calvin Klein jeans, until we see the whole Brooke Shields facing us with an alluring and seductive glance, saying or asking us, "You want to know what becomes between me and my Calvins? Nothing."
Oh, that is beautiful. So,
fashion in this way does not only determine certain belonging to someone else or to a group, it also determines the belonging to one's inner self. It shows you the limit of an individual being. And it is in this way that fashion appears here as an expression of the political logic. It is the logic of the care of the self. It's a factual condition, not only to be, but to be with someone else.
We're on. This is just ramblings. This is not...
This is just a test.
This is testing.
This is totally a test. This is Ugly Betty.
It's fun watching fashion on TV.
It is.
It becomes like a sitcom.
Let's see it move.
It's always personal, isn't it?
That was not a nude.
Who is he?
A noob dog. Oh. It is Ugly Betty. Can we just...
Why was she wearing makeup?
Indian.
As we all know, sparkling like a Bollywood star never looked so good. Michelle Park, New York 1.
Oh, velour suit. That feels coming.
The Aesthetics of Body Management, a history of freedom in the body and art since modernism. En Vogue sang, free your mind and the rest will follow. But I actually think the opposite is true. Free your body and the rest will follow. Freedom starts at the level of the body. If I had to choose, and I hope I never have to, I'd give up my freedom of speech way before I gave up freedom over my body. The ready-made is the closest art has ever gotten to being about freedom, and the ready-made was way more about the body than about the mind. The important ready-mades in art history have been objects that center on the body, and more specifically on the issue of cleaning in the body, urinals, vacuums, sinks. The ready-made is about leveling down the art object to address basic biological needs or to highlight how society neglects the needs of certain people. The ready-made is essentially worthless. You could buy a urinal at the toilet store or a vacuum at the vacuum store. The museum of the ready-made would look like Home Depot. It levels out wealth distinctions and the luxury object aspect of art that keeps it out of reach for most people. By getting rid of the notion of art, the ready-made freed the material body from the arbitrary social distinctions that place value upon it. Since David's Death of Marat, modernist painting has been about the rise of the autonomous mark as a sign of artistic resistance against the social inequality of the times. The gestures of modernist painting were those of freedom within a society in which not everyone had equal rights, in which some people had hot water, in which rich people were able to take hot baths and eat cake, and the masses were left cold, smelly, and hungry. This is why there were so many bathing scenes in Impressionist paintings, and why Marat himself was lying in a bath. The modernist brushstroke is basically a plea for everyone to be able to take a hot bath, and Duchamp saw that the only thing standing between modernist painting and true freedom was painting itself, so he got rid of it. The ready-made is only a reflection of the society outside of it, and it can only truly embody freedom if the society around it is free. Duchamp's urinal was exhibited during a moment when social barriers were breaking down, socialism was gaining steam, the bourgeoisie were under attack, and hordes of modernists were abandoning art for the functionalist dream of design for the masses. Within this context, Duchamp's urinal was the ultimate autonomous gesture. It demanded of its viewer the recognition that everyone needs to urinate, thereby recognizing that everyone has needs, not just rich people, and for a short moment it freed the material body from class boundaries. The ready-mades of Jeff Koons and Robert Gober show how the urinal was actually exclusive. It didn't include the specific bodies of women and homosexuals in its visions of freedom. Jeff Koons' vacuum critiques the way the urinal operated under the pretense of freedom but actually excluded women. If a woman used a urinal, she would piss all over herself. It also shows how the ritual of cleaning can be a symbol of gender inequality, much like the ritual of bathing was a symbol of social inequality for David, because it is women who are expected to clean the house and maintain an orderly domestic life. Koons' vacuums do not get rid of the notion of the work of art because they exist within a society that defines the work of art as a luxury object, a society based on private property and class distinctions. While the absence of a notion of art as a commodity in a given society does not mean that the body in that society will necessarily be free, take, for example, North Korea, the lesson of the ready-made is that the converse is true. Real freedom can't exist alongside a notion of the art object based on private property. Gober's sinks were about homosexuality and death. In his yellowed basins, the body and society are at irreconcilable odds because the demands of society on the body to be a certain way, i.e. clean and heterosexual, are an affront to artistic identity, and dial soap can't do much against AIDS. But it can't do much against cancer, head-on collision, or old age either. In the sink, the body confronts the real universal biological truth, finitude. It's a depressing conclusion to the ready-made's original utopian quest, an ending which sends the course of the ready-made off into cosmology, as well as loops us back to the beginning of the story. Because how the body is treated by a society, how it is pressured to perform certain functions or behave in a certain way, how it chooses to live and die, these are major questions that constantly need to be asked. Is it better to burn out or to fade away? To die of AIDS at 33? Or exercise and take fish oil every day until you're 90 and then get cryogenically frozen until science develops a way to make you live forever? People should be able to choose how to live and how to die and should not be killed by what they eat, by the air they breathe, by being out in the cold, by not having health care, by not having the money to take care of themselves. And if, when you think about these issues, you think, but who will pay for all of this? Then you're probably a douchebag. The ready-made has addressed these questions better than any type of art in history, but the ready-made can't ask them any longer. It doesn't have the power it used to, the power to truly embody freedom, the power to take down an entire art system. The ready-made is art. It's in museums. It's rare. It costs a lot of money when it goes to auction, and it just isn't getting the job done anymore. But the questions still have to be asked, and artists should be focused on figuring out how to ask them. Matthew Barney and Kurt Cobain are two artists who have continued the ideological project of freeing the body by jettisoning the form of the ready-made while preserving its thematic preoccupation with cleaning and health products. But the significance of these themes has changed. For David, a hot bath was something to fight for in the name of social equality and freedom for all. For Barney and Cobain, cleaning and exercising are part of a repressive ideology of cleaning, one that forces the body to participate in rituals that try to get it to function in certain socio-culturally productive ways. Barney focuses on gym equipment, working out, and Vaseline in performances that act out the needs of the body, demanding to be recognized and cared for. The significance of Vaseline lies in the fact that it is a palliative medium, which by virtue of its ability to heal irritated skin, exists to ease the friction that occurs when the unclean body brushes up against various socio-cultural pressures to get in shape. Cobain focuses on the relationship between rituals of cleaning and the mind. With song and album titles like Bleach, Smells Like Teen Spirit, Incesticide, and Nevermind, the message seems to be that the body's participation in these cleaning rituals occurs at the expense of the independent life of the mind. Far from being something to fight for, the shower is where the body is controlled and where the mind dies. It's significant that the picture on the cover of the album Nevermind is of a baby in water, a ritual which once represented equality, now represents drowning. While headed in the right direction, I think it's safe to say that neither Barney nor Cobain have been as successful as the ready-made once was in dismantling unjust social hierarchies or class, gender, and sexuality barriers. But again, it's not their fault. There's nothing they can do. It's just not the right time.
During 2008, I worked as a nightlife reporter magazine. About three nights a week, I descended upon the art world, the benefit circuit, and the fashion demi monde to ask intrusive questions of celebrities and other personalities. The job was especially important to me because I was going through a terrible time. My father had passed away from lung cancer. I was anxious around the people I knew. I depended upon their concern, but didn't know how to respond to it. I'm not sure to what extent I was even listening. I spent countless hours at my day job and at home, zoning out, hunched over my computer, absorbing every blog, magazine, and newspaper imaginable. In what I considered a strategic response to grief, I staved off isolation through the reverie of others. That way, I could be alone among people. Part of my tactic as an interviewer was to dress the part and research enough to appear well-versed in a given world. My disguise served as a defense. Taking on different roles while grieving was a literal form of evasion. A premiere was the opposite of the solitude I probably needed at the time. My hour of reckoning came in the fall when I attended a dinner for a softcore French fashion magazine. It was an over-the-top convention of international downtown, models, and forgotten hipsters of the 80s and 90s at an unopened restaurant. I wore a black shift with a twisted hem that I'd bought at a Japanese label sample sale and sat at a table of French stylists and photographers. Unlike at other events where I made perfunctory conversation with my table mates about what it's like going out every night, the stylists were uninterested. They also treated me as though I belonged by virtue of simply being there. I took this to mean I could have another glass of wine. I usually drank very little because I wanted to maintain professional distance. Practically, I knew I had to transcribe tape when the night was through and my deadline was in the morning. The longer I sat without talking, the further convinced I became that they would think I was indeterminately European. I eventually worked up the nerve to interview the Parisian editor-in-chief, also a noted playboy and art critic. According to blogosphere gossip, he was in his mid-40s and sometimes awoke at 8 p.m. to begin his tour de force partying. I was familiar with his uniform of pointy boots, leather jacket, dark aviators, and greasy hair, and from his own blog I knew that, despite his hirsute appearance, his body was incongruously hairless, possibly waxed. He wordlessly led me by the hand down a flight of stairs into the bowels of the kitchen, stood up against the back wall, and took a few snapshots of me, most likely for the party photos section of the magazine. Out of panic, I clung to the magazine script of serious Fashion Week questions: how editorial standards in New York stacked up against Paris, the commercialization of New York Fashion Week, and if he saw any risks in current fashion. "There are no risks in fashion, darling," he said, and ran his hands through my bangs. "What do you want to know? Ask me something real." The gauntlet was down. I'd never seen rote seduction before, and I was confused why it was happening to me. Instead, I ran through more backup questions, knowing full well that my comfortable participant observer status as a reporter had eroded hours ago. The questions rang hollow as I asked them. He continued touching my hair. When he realized that I refused to give in to his advances, he took me back upstairs by the hand. If I'd had my act together, I would have lobbed the same swagger back at him and asked, "Tell me about your first lover." My strength as a reporter came from having little investment in the personalities I interviewed. I framed them as characters, and since they often amused me, I would entertain them in response by behaving lackadaisically. By acting casually and humoring them, I could establish a level of comfort and get original material. There were two main types of questions I'd ask, depending on the interviewee: stock industry-related questions and ones tailored to a specific person. Within both categories, the questions could either be earnest in order to generate news or outrageous to pick up gossip or a funny item. In this instance, I fell back on the serious stock questions when I knew I would have had a better interview if I'd mimicked his sensibility. It was a knee-jerk reaction. I was stunned, unsure of what to ask, and didn't want to honor his inflated sense of self. I also didn't want to make out with a smarmy middle-aged man, but we were locked in a stalemate. My insistence upon maintaining professional and personal distance quashed his ability to play his role. The absurdity exhausted me. As a detached onlooker, I wanted to read ethnographic significance into all the fluff. The kinds of events I attended were advertisements for the industries that drive New York: boutique openings, charity cocktails at department stores and restaurants, fashion week parties, premieres, galas, and art openings. They trafficked in status, and I latched on to how the glamour was constructed. I wanted to concoct my own bizarre anthropology of artifice, the codes and the affects and the minutiae. I mostly racked up silly stories. It's hard to say what I was expecting at the time and what I did or didn't find, but I guess you could say I was looking for something more.
That's amazing. Is it made from crystal?
Yeah.
Probably.
Yeah. Like, what are we talking about now?
Hi.
This person. Hello. Okay.
Okay.
So what are we going to do now?
I don't know. Maybe we should go to sleep and get up really early. Like at like 8 and start again. Maybe we'll edit. We listen to the whole thing as it is and move shit around.